KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. My guest is the director, the Oscar-winning filmmaker, William Friedkin. I've been a fan of his for a long time. It's a thrill to have him on. His book, which could be called any number of things, including based on some of his adventures here, Reckless Endangerment, is instead called The Friedkin Connection and follows his entire career and starts off with an anecdote you told me when I met you a year ago about getting a package in the mail from Mr. Basquiat. Jean-Michel Basquiat, and what did he say in this?
I had no idea who he was. I had my offices at Warner Brothers then. This was in the early 70s. And the offices were at 666 Fifth Avenue, where I did The Exorcist. And they've gotten wise to that address, so that's gone. But one day a package came, a rather large package, and I opened it, and it was a number of watercolors. They were very graphic and colorful and interesting, but they really weren't to my taste. And with them was a letter from a young artist named Jean-Michel Basquiat, who said he was a fan of mine, and would I accept these watercolors as a gift? And I looked at them a few times, kept them on my desk for a couple of days, got bored with them, and tossed them in the wastebasket.
I mean, there are so many opportunities like that. You talk about your opportunity to have bought a share in the Boston Celtics in the book.
I could have owned a third of the Celtics. The owner was a man named Irv Levin, who was from out here, and he owned the team for a number of years. When I started to work out with the team in 1978, the Celtics finished last that year, and Irv went out to give a Life Achievement Award to Johnny Havlicek, who was retiring. And he went out to the old Boston Garden, and being from Hollywood, Irv had his shirt open and he had gold chains. And the team finished last that year. And he was booed on national television in Boston Garden. And so that Monday, the next day, he said to me, look, I've had it with these people. They have no gratitude. I've won a couple of championships here. This year we had a bad year. He said, I want to get out. He said, you love this stuff, you know, and Red likes you. Red Auerbach was the general manager then. And he said, I'll sell you a third of the team for what I paid for it. This was in 1978, the 78-79 season. What he paid for it a number of years ago was $450,000. So he was willing to sell me a third of the team for $150,000, and I could run it. And I talked to Red about it, and Red said, great, I'd love it. And I said, Red, you know, I'm not going to suggest what you should do. So I gave it to my business manager, and he looked at the papers, and he said, well, this might be a lot of fun for you, but the team loses money. I said, what? He said, yeah, they lose money. He said, they don't own the stadium. They don't own the TV station. And the team's not making money. I guess they might make money when they sell, but that's the only time they're making money. So I passed. And the next season, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson
came into the NBA.
And they changed the, among other things, they changed the game, but they changed the financial dynamic as well, to the point where these teams are now worth $1 billion and upwards. But I couldn't have competed at that time, because that's the time when the big corporations and the billionaires were buying the teams and paying outlandish salaries. I mean, a top player then was making $100,000.
One of the things I've mentioned to you when I met you, and it's been my feeling, and you really get into this in the book, how key music is to the way you work. And I've told you when I met you, and I've written this before, I think mm-hmm. you have a great ear and a specific talent for matching music to film. And Something I'd always thought, and you confirm in the book, is that the title of Sorcerer came from the Miles Davis avant-funk album Sorcerer.
That's where the title came from. My original title that I wanted to call the film was Ballbreaker. And the head of Universal looked at me across his desk, and he said, "Are you out of your mind?" He said, "What?" I said, "No, this is a great title." He said, "No way." So I didn't know what to call. I wasn't going to call it Wages of Fear because there was a great movie made, which was Wages of Fear.
And this is a remake of
this Clouseau's. Wasn't a remake, Elvis, is any more than if you do a new production of Hamlet, it's not a remake. Or any play, Death of a Salesman.
Forgive my imprecision, sir.
No, no. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Joe Turner's Here and Gone. The recent production that was downtown wasn't a remake, it was a new production. And that's how I viewed my production of Sorcerer. It was a new production of a classic text called La Salaire de la Peur, which was The Wages of Fear. And I actually went to H.G. Clouseau, who had no rights. The author, Georges Arnaud, owned the rights. But I went to Clouseau, and I told him what I was going to do, and he said, okay. And I dedicated the film to him, because his film's a masterpiece.
And you offered him a part of the profits as well.
Yes, and there were none. So, but maybe there will be.
Well, let's hope. But did you ever get a chance to tell Miles Davis about that?
Yeah, sure.
And what was his response when you told him?
He said, "Yeah, man, that's cool." I knew Miles very well when he was married to Cicely. And they used to come.
Cicely Tyson.
Yeah, they used to come to my house, or I'd see them at their place or somewhere. And if I could be said to have an idol anywhere, it would have been him. He influenced me as much as any piece of literature or any film.
No kidding.
His music. And that, I used to say to him, I used to want to talk to him about Kind of Blue and Sketches of Spain and those albums. He'd say, "That's the 60s, man. That stuff's the 60s.
Really?
Yeah, and he was going out there. He had gone electric by then, and he wasn't really interested in looking back or talking about the acoustic stuff. He re-recorded some of it in a different way and did long takes on So What, you know, some of his masterpieces, but electric. And he, like Bob Dylan, as you know, got a lot of heat for going electric. And, of course, it's pretty much all electric now, with rare exception. But the Miles electric stuff is fantastic. I was so influenced by the Sextet, which I used to see live at the Sutherland Hotel in South Chicago. And they played on top of the bar. This was in the 60s. Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, Philly Joe Jones. And Wynton Kelly. And sometimes Bill Evans.
Where was your big jazz film? Why did you not do that?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to do.
Is it?
Who are you going to get to impersonate Miles Davis? I mean, they made a film called Bird. And, you know, it's very hard to capture that lifestyle or that life.
Why not get Miles Davis to play Miles Davis?
Well, by then,
because you almost hired Jimmy Breslin to star in The French Connection.
That's true.
So, I mean, clearly you saw that Miles Davis in his own life was a movie star. Just hearing you talk about
clearly.
Him. And the gleam in your eye as you discussed Miles Davis, you saw that he was a star. Why not him to play Miles Davis?
I never thought of doing a film about jazz or Miles then. If I was and he was still around, I would try to do that. On the other hand, it's very difficult to get someone to play themselves. You know, if I said to you, "Elvis, I want you to play yourself in this picture," you might look at me like, "What am I talking about?" Because you have a different vision of yourself than I do, let's say. Like the two cops in The French Connection wanted to play themselves.
Right.
I couldn't see that. They saw themselves as gigantic heroes, and I didn't quite see it that way. I saw them as good street cops that had a mixture of good and evil. They only wanted to be presented without any warts. They wanted to be presented as heroes. And The French Connection is not about them as heroes. It's a, you know, it's about the thin line between the policeman and the criminal.
And as you mentioned in the book, is also an Americanization. It's certainly you see the influence of the Costa-Gavras Z in the French
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the film that I saw that made me realize I could do a feature film in a kind of documentary style.
Because you started off making a documentary for Chicago TV.
Yeah.
And that has a real, just the way the shaky cam, and also the music, by the way, in Z brings to mind the way you use music.
Yeah. The music from Z was by the great Greek composer, Mikos Theodorakis.
Yeah. You liked these things that really shook the status quo in every way, didn't you? Starting with music. You liked basically to deliver a body blow to what people perceived to be
sure.
What was going on.
Yeah, I didn't want, let's say, an Alfred Newman score for The French Connection, which were beautiful, or like the great Bernard Herrmann.
Well, tell your Bernard Herrmann story here for the listeners.
Well, I offered Bernard Herrmann The Exorcist. I flew to London. He had become like an expatriate. I took the work print to London and ran it for him, and I waited outside the studio after he had seen it, and he came out. He was a salty old guy from Brooklyn. He was sort of angry at Hollywood because Hitchcock had turned down two scores that he did.
But he also, at that point, when he was going to do the Torn Curtain score, he promised Hitchcock he'd do a jazz score, and he didn't.
Right. And Hitch broke it off with him after he had written legendary scores like North by Northwest and Psycho, for God's sake,
sure.
Hitchcock. So he was living in London. So I run the film for him, and he came out of the screening room and he said, "Well, I might be able to help you with this piece of crap." He said, "But you got to get rid of that first scene." I said, "You mean the Iraq sequence?" He said, "Yeah, get rid of it. What does that mean? Doesn't mean anything. I know you won't get rid of it because it costs you a bundle to do it, and you probably your life was in danger. But what does that scene mean? It means nothing." And so I listened to this, and he was even considering it. And then he said, "Look, kid, here's how I work. I'll record a score for you here. When I'm done, I'll mail it to you." And he said, "What I plan to do, there's a church here called St. Giles Cripplegate. And they have the most beautiful church organ sound I've ever heard. And I'll go in there and record. It might take me a couple of weeks. And I'll send you the bill and mail you the track." And I said, "You mean you're not interested in where I think we need music or what kind of music it should be?" He said, "How many films have you made, kid?" And I don't know, I'd made 6 or 7, maybe less. And he said, "I've done over 80 scores. He said, "So, you know, if you want to leave it here, leave it here." And I stood up. And I extended my hand and I said, "Thank you for letting me meet an interesting person." And I left. And I, as much as I did and do respect this guy as the greatest composer of scores for films, in my opinion, I wasn't about to leave the score to anybody. I had very firm ideas, and one of them was not to use a church organ in The Exorcist. He might have done a great score, but to me, that was a non-starter. No church organ in The Exorcist.
The cliche. We will take a break. My fascinating guest, one of the most fascinating people I've had on this show, was Billy Friedkin. His book, his autobiography, is The Friedkin Connection by William Friedkin. A memoir is The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is William Friedkin. Forgive me for being too informal. His book is The Friedkin Connection, a memoir. One of the things, and as long as we're talking about scores, I think one of the most interesting film scores in the history of the medium is the Cruising score, which goes from classical to jazz to punk. I mean, I've never heard a score like that before. I mean, you've got the Germs. Mm-hmm. You've got Ralph Towner.
Yeah.
You've got Tom Brown.
Jack Nitzsche.
Barry Phillips.
Yep. Barry Phillips. Barry Phillips,
yes.
Yeah.
And that great classical, that piece that you said Al Pacino gave to you.
Yeah, it was a string quartet by Luigi Boccherini. And Al was listening to it, and he said, listen to this. I think it's great. He didn't suggest it for the movie. And when I first heard it, I didn't think it would have anything to do with the movie.
And it's such an evocative piece of music that suggests something very different than what we're seeing in the movie.
Exactly. And it's obviously a pure piece of classical music. But I used to go around in and around the Strip and elsewhere and hear these garage bands and punk bands that were playing.
What was like the first time you heard the Germs? Where did you hear those guys play?
Some club on Sunset Boulevard. I don't remember whether it was the Viper Room or some even off-the-wall joint that may not even be there. And then they played obscure clubs around town that must be long gone. And I heard these bands, and I loved the energy and the edginess. And there was a touch of evil there, too. And I met Darby Crash, who was the lead singer. When I met him, he was never sober, you know.
My God.
Never in his right mind. He was off the wall, as was this great music that the Germs did. So we used them and a number of other local bands that we found. There's a track, do you remember Mutiny?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a track by Mutiny.
Well, the film ends with a great Willie DeVille song.
Willie DeVille's song is like used twice in the film. It's so easy.
Easy, yes.
It's called, and it's evocative and provocative. It's wonderful.
Well, I mean, I'm proud to say I'm an owner of the Cruising soundtrack on vinyl because that's basically the only way you can find that Willie DeVille song until Quentin Tarantino put on the Death Proof soundtrack. But what I think is so interesting about that score is it because the movie itself goes through so many different emotional states, the music captures all of that. I mean, and interestingly enough, if you played the music that would have been played in those clubs at the time, it would have been disco.
It would have been Donna Summer. That's what was played in the clubs. Now, I didn't go to discos to shoot the picture. I went to the S&M clubs, the hardcore S&M clubs,
right,
which most gay people had never seen, let alone so-called straight people, had never been in these places. But the music was even there largely disco because they were dance clubs,
right,
you know. But I put this punk music in and classical music and contemporary jazz, as you pointed out, because I was listening to that, and I thought it fit the mood better. The Donna Summer tracks were really happy and upbeat and too far in that direction for some of the murders that are depicted in Cruising.
It's the treatment, my guess, is William Friedkin. His book is The Friedkin Connection, a memoir. It's a terrific read. I mean, you are out to evoke so many moods, and you find a way, though, to use pre-recorded music and score in a way that I think was unique to you. I think you really broke ground with that. And I'm glad you talk so much about music in the book, The Friedkin mm-hmm. Connection, because people just tend to not mention it. And for me, it's the way that you work as a filmmaker.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the music is a statement on its own that either underlines or goes parallel or sometimes against the grain of what's happening on the screen. And that's how I view the entire soundtrack. And I do it all separately. I don't really record the soundtrack of the picture while I'm shooting it. My biggest influence, Elvis, was probably dramatic radio from the 1940s, before there was television in people's homes. And they used to have these dramatic shows that KCRW used to play, tapes of them. I don't know if they still do. But there were great dramatic radio programs like Suspense and The Inner Sanctum and I Love a Mystery and scores of other great dramatic radio shows, the Lux Radio Theater. And, of course, these dramatic programs worked on the imagination of the audience. You couldn't see anything, but you could hear only sounds and music and the human voice. And it would create word pictures in your mind's eye. And it inspired me tremendously. I was an avid listener of dramatic radio, and that's how I remembered Mercedes McCambridge, who I sought out to do the voice of the demon in The Exorcist. She was a radio actress before she had ever made a film.
It's the treatment. We're talking sound and its fury with William Friedkin. His terrific memoir is The Friedkin Connection, a memoir. But as we're talking about these things, though, I just was thinking about the way you talk about using sound and re-recording the gunshots in The French Connection in the book, but also using other sounds as well, because it's not just the gunshots, is it? In the way you use all kinds of sounds in The Exorcist that people really aren't hearing. I mean, that kind of subliminal thing is important to you too, is it not?
Yes. The soundscape. The sound is as important to me as the picture, and I view them separately and I work on them separately, including the dialogue. Very often, I'm shooting out in the street and with handheld cameras and with traffic around, and so a lot of the dialogue isn't always usable. But I found that I could bring the actors back into a soundstage like this one, and they could look at themselves on the screen and they could repeat their dialogue, and I would have a clean track instead of a sound that was encumbered by noises you might not necessarily want. Then I'd add those sounds back in at a different, more controllable level.
But I think you found an aural kind of correlation for so many of these protagonists that you made movies about who were incredibly self-destructive. It almost feels like there are these discordant, dissonant sounds in their heads, in their soul somewhere, and you found an aural way to make these things play out in the film, don't you?
Certainly, with Hackman and The French Connection, that comes to mind.
But you could say the same thing about the guys and the boys in the band who are living with self-loathing, or Pacino's character in Cruising, or Peter Falk in The Brinks Job, or going to the last film you made, even with Matthew McConaughey in Killer Joe. I mean, that kind of self-destructive, self-loathing character needs that kind of dissonant sound in the film, doesn't it?
Yes, and again, the score there is very low level. It's more of a musical presence than a statement. It's like a cold hand on the back of your neck. And that's how I felt about what was going on in those scenes in Killer Joe. I didn't want a score that would be like either romantic or frightening or disturbing, let alone an action score. I wanted just a musical presence. And so if you have a good sound system, there's a lot of things that go on in those tracks that aren't immediately apparent, that are all sort of subjective and almost illusory. Something that cannot really be heard, but it's only felt.
For me, having read a bunch of stuff to get ready for this and watching the movies, it was always been shocking to me that nobody ever mentioned the way you use music and sound in film. I mean, because I think the movies are often people finding them to be so assaultive and abrasive and shake them out of the kinds of things that movies often did that they didn't get a chance to really evaluate you as a technical filmmaker.
Well, I appreciate that, but I was more influenced by the music in the making of the film than the film inspired the music. With most of these scores, I would either take things that existed and recombine them, or I'd hear a band like Wang Chung and Tangerine Dream that hadn't really been heard over here. I heard them in Germany and in England. Wang Chung.
When you admonish them to not do a song with the title To Live and Die.
You have read this book. When I hired them to do the score, before I'd made the film, To Live and Die in L.A., I just loved their sound.
And the album Points on the Curve, which has
Points
a song.
Points on the Curve, which is a great track by two guys, Jack Hughes and Nick Feldman. And I said, okay, guys, and again, as I did with Tangerine Dream, here's the script. I'm not going to show you the film. You write your score based on what you are inspired by from this script and from what I've told you, and then send it to me when you're done, and I'll fit it in. I said, but don't, under any circumstances, write a song called To Live and Die in L.A.
And how's the movie start, Billy?
With the song To Live and Die in L.A., because they came out here from England where they lived, And I showed them the film and how I had used their tracks. And they went away the next day and they were inspired to write that theme song, which I told them not to write. And I listened to it and I thought it was great.
It is great.
So I went out and shot the first scene in the film that I didn't have in the movie.
That scene going through Century City.
Yes, where you first introduced the guys protecting President Reagan in a motorcade on the way to a hotel in Beverly Hills. And I didn't have that scene in the script or in the film. I went out and shot that scene and took a lot of footage from the body of the rest of the film and recombined that footage as a kind of a prologue with the first scene involving the terrorist who's trying to blow up the President Reagan. And this was 1985. And I did it solely to use the song.
No kidding. Well, you don't say that in the book. But one thing...
I don't. I should have. if that song's not in the book, send it back to me and I'll give you your money back because that's a key song.
No, but
story.
That's a great story. But often there's a one vocal piece in each movie that does something, or an old school piece that sort of works against the contemporary sound. Parker or
Walter Jackson.
Walter Jackson.
An uphill climb to the bottom.
When I met you, I asked you about
that's
this.
That's right. I know that was so obscure. Elvis, we could not clear that song. Nobody knew who owned it. Nobody knew where Walter Jackson was.
Would you say it's a great R&B song that's used in To Live and Die in L.A.?
Right. I heard it on the radio somewhere, and I got a hold of it. And then, of course, as you know, you have to go out and clear music that's been recorded if you're going to use it. You clear it with a publisher, often with the artist himself. We could not find the record company. We couldn't find Walter Jackson or his heirs. Now, I see that his stuff has since been re-released. There's three or four collections of Walter Jackson out there, including a beautifully recorded track of An Uphill Climb to the Bottom. And I actually called that's the title of one of my chapters.
Yes.
I think the song is so beautiful and evocative, and I put it in the middle of a Wang Chung score. But I remember the executive from Geffen Records, who did the soundtrack for
Because Wang Chung were on Geffen Records.
And they had Wang Chung. And the executive there said to me, "What's the matter? You got two people making love there. They can't make love to Wang Chung? What are you using this blues song for?" I said, "I just feel it, man. I just think that that's what's on the radio at that time." And I loved the song, and I shoehorned it in. That's my only reason for using it. I wanted people to hear the Walter Jackson song, An Uphill Climb to the Bottom. I guess I'm a frustrated DJ.
Well, Billy, we're out of time. Thank you so much for doing this. I can't thank you
enough. It's a great pleasure. I love the show. I love being interviewed by you. I think you bring out the best in people.
That's very kind of you to say. And you bring out the best of yourself in this book. The book is The Friedkin Connection, a memoir by William Friedkin. I can't thank you enough. Thanks again for doing this.
My pleasure.
Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. It's an uphill climb to the bottom for me. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.